Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling, he's Leighton Kling, and coming up on today's show, got a great interview. Talk about that first, Megan Martindale, who is CBRE's Global Head of Retail Research. She's going to dive into the numbers as far as what we're seeing over the last couple of months as far as traffic, as far as retail mixed-use centers, as far as food and beverage retail and the combination, as well as how many rents are coming in from retailers. So some great data she'll go over in that interview. As far as news stories are concerned, we've got several we'll talk about. Office Depot issued surprisingly positive earnings. We'll also discuss Connex's 2020 retail benchmark survey, and that's going to talk a little bit about facilities management as it pertains to retail. We'll also talk about restaurants diving into grocery. But first, a reminder to like us and rate us however you access us, whether that be on Podcast Addict, on Apple Podcasts, on any other podcast listening service. If you like us, certainly those ratings help others to find us. You can also check us out on social media, Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. Our first story, though, something I haven't already talked about, but it's a deep dive. We love deep dives. We love grocery. Those two things combining. Interesting data comes by way of the National Grocers Association regarding frozen foods purchases. Now, to be honest, the data was released on NGA's blog, but comes via the American Frozen Food Institute and 210 Analytics. This was, Leighton, an over 30-page report. And honestly, it's an aspect of panic buying that hasn't really been discussed in most retail news outlets as yet, in part because it doesn't generate as many clicks as talking about Macy's does. But the data does shine a very bright light on a part of grocery retail that maybe isn't the sexiest, but it's been very busy over the last 2 months.
Yeah, in fact, this data suggests that over the last 2 months, 86% of all consumers have purchased frozen food items. This compares with year-round frozen food penetration of 99%. However, as IBM's study pointed out this week, only about 70% of consumers are still shopping for food and essentials. So 86% reflects a number beyond those who are even going out to shop. You think of e-commerce orders, likely about 39% of those surveyed said they had bought frozen food items online at least once during March and April. Frozen foods, by the way, were already on the upswing pre-pandemic. In each of the last 3 years, frozen food sales has outpaced most other macro-level grocery categories in sales increases. According to IRI, sales growth in frozen foods has exceeded around 2% each year since 2017. This may be one reason, Trent, why Dollar Tree and Family Dollar have decided to put freezers and coolers into their respective stores. This was one of several reasons why we speculated a potential future shortage in frozen food warehouse space as well. Several months ago, consolidation and barriers to entry are both high and sales have been improving. The overall findings, Trent, from these studies, like a lot of other household products and food items, frozen food sales have stabilized somewhat to a new normal for pandemic buying in April. The week ending March 22nd alone, frozen food saw a whopping 94% increase in sales year over year, according to all of this data. For perspective, this data suggests that total store grocery sales were up around 60% in the same time frame. April 2020 still brought major increases year over year for frozen foods, but they've stabilized somewhat around 30 to 35% overall. Meanwhile, total grocery sales are up in the neighborhood of around 15 to 16%. Therefore, we can see that the increase runs parallel consistently with overall food sales. 90% of consumers are eating meals prepared at home a lot more frequently. However, frozen food has seen a greater increase than many other areas of grocery. We should note also that these numbers, as well as the rest of the numbers we'll discuss here on this story, come from sales of frozen pizza, vegetables, fruits, entrees, and so forth. So products like ice cream, for example, are omitted from this particular data set, but we'll talk about them in a bit. The increase is a function of new customers to the frozen food category and existing customers spending more and buying more frozen items as a result. 7% of customers who rarely or never purchased frozen food items prior to the pandemic have been purchasing frozen foods over the last 2 months. While this may not sound like much, imagine us talking about a retailer having a 7% boost in their traffic numbers. That would be stellar, and that would be something that we would really focus in on. So in store terms, frozen foods are seeing both traffic increase, but also a major ticket increase as well. The study notes that Gen Z buyers as being a big group insofar as new customers to frozen foods. Of course, this is big for the frozen foods industry and retailers as they seek to make an impression on this crucial age group that really is in the grocery buying infancy, so to speak. Additionally, boomers are among the group that is seeking out frozen foods for the first time recently. One of the things that both the NGA and AFFI noted is that boomers may have seen frozen foods in a negative light, having grown up and matured in the TV dinner era. I know, Trent, we were big into TV dinners growing up, but frozen food manufacturers are hoping that the current, much improved status of many frozen meals will retain customers in this older age group. And Trent, I will have to say, they are much healthier offerings than what we had grown up on.
Much healthier, but they taste a lot better than some of those old TV dinners that were around back in the 80s and 90s. Now, even before that, into the 60s and 70s. Now, as far as existing frozen foods customers spending more, among those that had already considered themselves regular consumers of frozen foods pre-pandemic, 70%, so 70% of existing frozen foods customers say they are buying more than usual now over the last couple of months. Now, that in and of itself isn't a surprise. Most grocery consumers are buying more than usual with restaurant closures, with those numbers that Leighton talked about, more people preparing meals at home. But the key figure is that 68% of those existing frozen food customers are trying new brands and new products. So basically, this is an unprecedented time. You never see numbers like this where so many people are trying new brands and products in a certain space. The time for those that are maybe new entries to the space or new brand extensions in the space to shine and attract permanent customers. And we've talked in the past about how difficult frozen food shelf space is to come by for manufacturers. We talk about what a victory it's been for Halo Top to score so much room in grocers, in supermarkets, but it's costly. That shelf space is costly, and it's difficult for retailers to add frozen shelf space. So basically, it's a zero-sum game. If you give shelf space to one thing, you've got to kick something else out. You've got to make room for it because you're not generally adding more freezers in your refrigerated goods section. So these numbers suggest that what we could see here is basically a land rush for up-and-coming brands to dethrone those long-standing ones. Like when you were talking about those TV dinners, you think of Banquet and you think of other frozen brands like Bird's Eye and so forth. There's a real opportunity for up-and-coming brands or new brand extensions to overtake those existing brands for that shelf space. Now, all of these numbers that we've talked about to this point resulted in 73% of shoppers surveyed experiencing out-of-stock conditions for one or more frozen food products they were seeking to purchase during the time period in question. A lot of out-of-stocks in general in grocery, but we're seeing that specifically in frozen foods. I remember for about a month, I was unable to buy frozen spinach anywhere here in Colorado. So far, at least, early returns suggest that the increased traffic surrounding the frozen food section has resulted in customer satisfaction, though, and customers wanting to come back for more. So this is an important second component to that number we were just talking about. With so many people trying new and different products, how satisfied are they? Well, AFFI asked that question, and customers were particularly happy with the convenience and quality of new frozen food purchases. They were asked on a 5-point Likert scale, 1 being the least satisfied, 5 being the most satisfied, how to rate the convenience, quality, price point, and other aspects of frozen food. Convenience rated a 4.3 for the items that they purchased, but quality came in at a 4.1. So this suggests that customers are increasingly happy with what they are purchasing in the frozen food section, especially those new products that are out there. Additionally, half of grocery consumers who have purchased frozen food since March say they will purchase more frozen food in the future. So this kind of speaks to the fact that they are setting buying habits for the future. It's not just a pandemic-related purchasing of these frozen foods. They're saying, hey, we've tried this stuff out. We're looking to maybe continue to purchase this in the future, even when things go back to whatever normal happens to be in several months. The breakdown of that 50% is that 32% say they will purchase somewhat more frozen food, but 18% of customers that have bought frozen food during the pandemic say they will purchase a lot more going forward. So also very important for grocers to kind of keep that in mind. It's not about what people have purchased, because every grocery store has metrics on what people have purchased. But the important part is now we know people intend to purchase more going into the future. So how does this influence the decision-making of these grocery stores? And granted, some customers, you're going to reach a limit at some point, because freezer space at home, just like at the grocery store, is limited. I don't anticipate a lot of people going out to buy chest freezers to stock up on all this frozen food. So there is a limit to this. You are going to see a natural ceiling just because it has to remain frozen, but still something very, very important for grocers to note.
So that brings us to the category breakdown. After all, if we are going to be keeping an eye towards frozen food trends and how grocers dole out shelf space, it is important to break things down a bit further. The most important and most frequently purchased categories were frozen vegetables, meat, poultry, and pizza. In fact, frozen meat saw a triple-digit growth during the first 4 weeks of pandemic buying. Going beyond just triple digits, meat alone saw a 163% year-over-year increase the week ending March 22nd. This is due to, in large part, customers trying frozen meat for the first time. 16% of meat buyers for the pandemic period surveyed said it was indeed their first time buying frozen meat. In particular, meat and poultry is typically stocked in the meat section of grocery stores. It will be interesting to see if customers continue to opt for frozen product out of the convenience and shelf life that it brings, causing grocers to upgrade from refrigerated cases and meat sections to freezers that are new. By the way, it bears noting that the meat section freezers are open-faced, meaning that higher electric costs in the summer and greater heating costs in the winter will occur. If grocers opt to include more of these in their stores, they may seek to use maybe those higher efficiency closed units that are out there. In any case, first-time trials for consumers was the highest in frozen meat and poultry categories, but this was followed by sides, fruit, and entrees. For those that were existing regulars in the frozen food section, about one-third stocked up on vegetables more than usual. While we discussed meat, it makes sense that fruits and vegetables are on the list of increased sales as well, especially with people seeking to reduce store trips. Buying highly perishable products like berries or spinach in frozen form would allow for use over a greater period of time. This is very logical and completely makes sense here. 17% of those buying fruit during the pandemic period said it was actually their first time buying the frozen fruit. So very interesting there. One interesting thing is that while frozen beverages, think concentrated juices like orange juice, lost overall frozen food market share during this time, they saw larger gains in comparison to other food categories in April. Juices were up 63.7% year over year for the week ending April 12th, for example, which was the best of any particular category. Frozen baked goods also lagged somewhat, again, compared to others, but saw an odd spike in April as well, with sales increases of around 63.2% year over year for the same week. Another interesting thing is that high-income shoppers were about 50% more likely than lower-income shoppers to stock up on frozen vegetables more than usual during the pandemic, of course. They were about 60% more likely to stock up on fruits. Some of this is due to the fact that lower-income shoppers were less likely to stock up on things overall, so they had less funds coming in to buy more frozen foods just in general, but certain categories like appetizers and snacks were nearly even in stocking up habits across all income levels. So We dive into all of this to say what? Well, how will grocers leverage this information going forward? Obviously, they have all of this data too, and they should be looking at all of it, mulling it over. It is certainly possible to see if grocers will shift their shelf space around products that are being trialed for the first time during the pandemic that may have legs for consumers long term. But Trent, there are a lot of things to be mindful of here if you're in the grocery retail space.
Especially if you're looking at the supply chain, and we'll talk with someone at IBM about this on next week's show, actually, but it's more important than ever for grocers to connect local trends with supply chain rather than looking at the supply chain as a nationalized thing. For example, if we know during Black Swan events like this, higher income families tend to disproportionately stock up on fruits and vegetables, the supply chain for grocers in those areas, it needs to be ready to fulfill that demand. Now, we're not saying that grocers in these areas should stock more of a healthy product to begin with, because we believe that everyone should have ready access to healthy foods, but it is more important than ever for grocers to understand their surroundings as they pertain to the supply chain. And while many likely do for normal sales periods, what we're talking about here is something that, while it hasn't happened recently with this pandemic issue, it may happen more frequently going forward, especially once you kind of break the seal of saying, hey, we're going to close things down, we're going to limit things. The next time something like this comes along, and it may be just a few years for all we know, contingency plans are a must, especially as it pertains to supply chains. So rather than, say, spreading those fruits and vegetables out in terms of being ready to fulfill, grocers need to be ready to fulfill on a specific store-by-store basis. And honestly, as I mentioned, we'll talk to Carl Haller of IBM about that, but something that IBM is working with a lot of retailers towards, because there are retailers out there, even larger chains, that have these numbers that just aren't able to implement smart supply chain management on a store-by-store level. And certainly, if you're an independent grocer, these numbers are very, very important to take a look at, because it's not only what's going on in your micro market, but what could potentially go on in the future if another such event like this pops up. So very interesting to take a look at an area of grocery retail that we don't talk about often, but had the opportunity to look at a deep amount of data thanks to AFFI. So coming up after this break, we'll discuss more data with Megan Martindale, who is the global head of retail research at CBRE. We're going to take a look at rents coming in from retailers right now as things stand, as well as traffic trends that we're seeing surrounding mixed-use retail centers and food and beverage. It's become clear, particularly over the past 2 weeks, that impacts from coronavirus-related closures will ripple maybe farther along than most anticipated. And while last week we took a bit of a historical look at the retail real estate market over the past 5 years, we're going to take a data-driven approach to what we're seeing in shopping centers in the here and now. To that end, we're joined by Megan Martindale, the Global Head of Retail Research at CBRE. Megan, we're delighted to have you back on the podcast, this time talking about a very different topic than the holiday trends we were seeing last time.
Absolutely. I'm glad to be back with you guys. A lot to talk about in the industry these days.
Certainly is. And the first thing we wanted to touch on, I think the aspect of these coronavirus-related closures that has maybe produced the most headlines in the retail world over the past week or two is rents, as in some retailers choosing or not being able to pay rents, others paying rents as normal. Now, CBRE always has great data across all different shopping centers and real estate setups. So what are you seeing as far as trends surrounding payment of these rents?
Yeah, well, the first real conversation was around April rent, you know, and that pretty much dominated everyone's lives the last 6 weeks. And now here we are coming up on Friday being May 1st again as well. So, you know, time is going very quickly. If we take a look back to April rent, from a property management standpoint in the properties that we manage, we saw on average about a 44% retail rent payment in April, so 44% of rents paid. And we have kind of a more informal survey of a breakdown of that. It's probably not surprising to see the fact that most of the rents that were paid were in the grocery anchored centers, 55 to 80% of rent was received by the landlords in grocery anchored centers. And it's important to note that that doesn't necessarily equate to 55 to 80% of the tenants paid their rent, but that was total rents received. And in many cases, if you look at grocery and or pharmacy as the traditional anchors in those types of centers, you know, a large portion of the rent came from those types of tenants who were still obviously open as essential business and then also seeing, you know, surge in traffic and sales. If we look at the non-grocery kind of strip center environment, that rent payment percentage was between 20 and 40% of rents paid in April. And really, the category that was hit the hardest were malls and outlet centers. And we estimate that only 10 to 20% of the rents were received in April in those types of properties. And it, again, it's not surprising given that, you know, most of those properties are dominated by non-essential businesses. And then we had already started to see a lot of the store closure mandates, non-essential, you know, store closures go into effect prior to and leading up to April 1st.
So I wanted to piggyback off of that a bit because we're talking about, you know, who's paying rent, who isn't. The grocery anchored centers comparatively are performing fairly well as far as people still paying rent and tenants still paying rent. But one of the other things that I know you've got data suggesting is that retail investment transactions have slowed. And I'm kind of curious, has there been a little bit more attention paid from investors to those grocery anchored centers from their perspective? Or what kind of trends are you seeing surrounding the interest that is coming in from investors?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, look, grocery anchored has been the darling of the industry the last several years, even before COVID. I mean, if you look at the strength in the grocery industry, relatively low e-com penetration, you know, really looking at the tenant mix in those types of centers around daily, weekly needs, services, fitness, F&B, grocery, pharmacy, you know, these have been all very strong, dominant retail categories. So it's been logical to see sort of that performance continue to outperform some of the other categories that have been hit and segments that have been hit in retail, like the malls, for instance. So I think, you know, this time frame and seeing the surge spending of essential goods and, you know, what we're going through with COVID, but then also as we see that leveling off as we return to what our new normal is going to be, I think it will just further emphasize the strength of the grocery anchored sector. And in terms of, you know, investment activity, we have seen a slowdown during this crisis period, but I think it just accelerates what we were seeing even before, which is the strength around that segment of the grocery anchored centers, and definitely see that continuing, you know, as we start coming out of this.
Now, we mentioned that slowdown in terms of investment activity. Is it a matter of just new properties not being listed because of coronavirus-related impacts, or is it a matter of properties being listed, or not enough buyers, or is it a combination of the two?
Yeah, it's a combination of everything. I mean, we're definitely in a pause just from a transaction standpoint in terms of, you know, properties coming to market, what the buyer appetite is, impacts to the lending environment as well. You know, there's a lot more complexity to all of that. But overall, I think, you know, everyone's kind of taking a pause to see when we start coming out of this and, you know, what the market's going to look like. And I will say, you know, I think part of that pause has really just been driven by the fact that everyone has been in triage mode. You know, so retailers have been focused on their operations, investors and landlords have been focused on their existing portfolios, lenders the same. So I think until that clears a little bit, we're going to stay kind of in this slowdown of new investment activity. But, you know, we do fully expect that once we start to come out of this and things start to reopen, that we'll see renewed transaction activity towards the end of the year.
Apart from investment activity, we know even more so than retail stores, restaurants have been particularly hard hit. What are the anticipated impacts as far as potential permanent restaurant closures and also what this might do to the traffic and some of those mixed-use developments?
Yeah, so F&B has clearly been, you know, arguably the hardest hit of the retail industry, and we are watching the reopening of that very carefully. I think it's safe to say that we will see sort of a first wave of F&B operators who aren't able to reopen. And then we're also now looking at the big kind of reopening reentry period that kicked off as early as Friday in states like Georgia and will be, you know, phased throughout the country over the coming weeks and months. The main thing to really be mindful of here is that it is a lot easier to reopen a retail store than it is a restaurant. There's a lot more that goes into the rehiring, the retraining, lining up all of your food purveyors and vendors again. We are heading into seeing what the social and physical distancing restrictions are going to be in restaurants. So we're fully anticipating reduced seating capacities and still a focal point on a lot of delivery, takeout, curbside pickup, et cetera. So the operational challenges around all of that, again, are much more complex than, you know, reopening a retail store. So this is really the focal point, I think, over the next several weeks and through summer, is to see how the restaurants that do reopen, how they're reopening, what the safety measures are that have to go into place for those restaurants. And it's obviously sort of the public safety side and that social responsibility side of doing everything they can, you know, to make it a safe environment for their consumers. But then it's also the consumer appetite for eating out again. There's definitely, I think, an element of pent-up demand because people have been at home quarantining, cooking themselves. They're going to want to get back out into, you know, dining and shopping, but they're also coming out of crisis. They're going to have a level of caution that as an industry, we need to address, and we need to make sure consumers feel safe and secure coming back into, you know, the retail world and certainly the food and beverage world. And because of the elements of dining and lingering and socialization that has always surrounded restaurants, there's a very strong focal point in what we need to do to help get the restaurant successfully reopened, allaying those consumer concerns, and, you know, kind of reintroducing that dining experience to customers.
And part of that allayment of, if you will, of customer concerns is picking up on those operational challenges as far as the demand when it comes to maybe curbside pickup or other health-related restrictions, accommodating those health recommendations, if you will. Has there been any talk to this point, or what's activity been like as far as maybe retrofitting some of these mixed-use properties to accommodate some of that optionality, whether it be retail stores or F&B?
Well, specific to mixed-use, I think any retail component, whether you're talking about retail in a mixed-use environment or you're talking about a mall or a shopping center, they're going to face some of the same challenges in terms of what social distancing and physical distancing measures are still going to be in place. Curbside pickup has become obviously, you know, the big focal point, and I think will continue beyond this. I think it was the sort of paradigm shift in what our next delivery and pickup preferences are. But you have to create the right physical environment for it. So in some cases, you have space dedicated you can use for it, and it's just more of an operational challenge to kind of pull everything together and use that space. We've also talked with landlords who had not previously had any physical space to accommodate the likes of curbside delivery. So they're actually physically, you know, mapping it out and figuring out where to do curb cuts and how does this work from a traffic flow perspective. And, you know, so there's a wide variety of things that are going to have to be addressed sort of property by property and space by space, if you will. But I think as a whole, the industry is really looking at this like, okay, you know, what measures need to go into place of how sort of the consumer shopping is going to have shifted, and then how to again make those customers feel safe coming back into the physical environment, whether it's in a mixed-use project or in a mall.
So I'm kind of curious as well, because we talk about maybe adjustments that need to be made. You talked about planning as far as, you know, where are the curb cuts, what's the traffic looking like. But we know that this is kind of providing a bit of a reset point, if you will, for a lot of shopping centers. Is there a particular trend outside of accommodating maybe, you know, curbside pickup or something along those lines on the shopping center front we might expect to see when retail and restaurants kind of slowly reawaken?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things, and I think it's really two phases, if you will. There's the immediate reopening that we're heading into now, and the things that are going to be implemented during that time. So we're seeing, you know, still a lot of physical and social distancing. We're seeing some malls control traffic that, you know, they don't get too crowded and they can control the densities. We're seeing a lot of increased operational issues being addressed, like cleaning, especially of the high-touch surfaces, and what areas might stay closed longer, i.e. food courts and children's play areas and things where you have to be really concerned about the virus. So there's that immediate kind of changes that need to be made from a operational standpoint, even a marketing standpoint, and how signage and support from a mall owner can really help the retailers and help the consumers kind of navigate the physical changes to these environments. And then I think that's going to last however long this lasts until we get past, you know, the fear of any second waves, certainly until, you know, while we don't have a vaccine yet, but we're seeing increased testing, which is positive. So I think there's a phase there, that kind of that reentry phase, if you will. And then I think longer term, I do think we're going to really see, you know, new designs implemented. We're going to see operational changes. We're going to see business models change that are going to incorporate some of the longer term ramifications, you know, to this whole situation in kind of what the future store looks like, what the future mall looks like, et cetera. But it will take time to get there. I think that the first and foremost goal is get reopened and do so safely. And so if density control measures, if temperature taking, if that's requiring masks, as many cities and states are, you know, we'll see that kind of as the initial wave. And then longer term, a big component of the conversation that's out there in the industry right now is, what does this do to our physical spaces going forward? How are we going to look at mall design, store design, et cetera, and incorporate some of these things that are going to be longer lasting versus, you know, immediate public health crisis?
We were talking before the interview started about people don't really realize just how deep the CBRE research goes and how much research that CBRE as a whole does. So I wanted to ask you, just as we did in the last interview, what's next on the menu as far as research is concerned from CBRE's perspective?
Yeah, certainly. So we, as you can well imagine, have pivoted much of our content this year around COVID. So we have several short-term, kind of immediate-term reports coming out that are addressing the COVID implications to specific categories, i.e., you know, F&B, grocery, entertainment, et cetera. And then we are working on a couple of longer-term reports that will come out over the next, you know, call it 6 months, about what the recovery really looks like, looking at different markets around the U.S. and then also different segments of retail. And the other big component, of course, that this really accelerates is, what is the conversation now around e-commerce? So we had had our predictions about what we thought e-commerce growth would be over the next decade, really, as we were looking ahead to 2030, and much of that has accelerated. So we're working very hard to come up with our revised projections on the e-commerce side, but then also looking at specific categories and also looking at, what is the interim surge while the shutdowns were in place and people were working from home, et cetera, but then how much of that, you know, comes back to brick and mortar when things start to reopen, and what has been the long-term changes in consumer behaviors. We've produced a lot of incredible content globally across all sectors, so I would encourage everyone to visit cbre.com/COVID-19, and you can access all of the reports that we've put out globally across all sectors, all regions. We're certainly populating it with more and more every day, but it's an incredible resource for our clients and for the industry as we're tracking everything related to COVID.
We'll be looking forward to all of that. Well, once again, Megan Martindale, CBRE's Global Head of Retail Research, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. It's always a delight.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Well, we thank Megan for joining us. It's always great to have Megan on the show to discuss these issues. And as I mentioned during the interview, CBRE is as much a research institution as it is a real estate broker and all the other things that CBRE does in terms of property management and maintenance. So great to take a look at some of the numbers that they are churning out. Well, speaking of numbers, Connex releases their 2020 Retail Benchmark Survey. And for those that are not familiar, Connex is a consortium for facilities managers and suppliers for those facilities managers. When you look at facilities management as it pertains to retail, it takes on a broad definition, could mean anything from custodial to regular facilities maintenance to major remediation work. But it is certainly a different perspective because we don't talk about this a lot, and it's not talked about a lot in the retail news community. So we always jump at the chance to discuss their annual retail benchmark survey when we get the chance. And a big shout out, by the way, to Bruce Condit. He is Connex's PR point person, so to speak. And we met him several years ago at NRF. He does amazing work with them and hooks us up with a lot of great information, including some of these standout numbers.
As we dig into some of the standout numbers, we'll give an overall view of the survey findings. Some of them make sense in the current landscape, but others are indeed surprising, so we'll note them here on the podcast for that very reason. The numbers are essentially from 2019, since several of them would not be possible to adequately gauge for 2020 as of yet. Among the common sense numbers here that we found, 93% of all facilities trades were outsourced by retail facilities during the period surveyed. This is something that has long been known regarding retail. The vast majority of facilities maintenance is outsourced to third-party firms who specialize in a given market. However, this is something that we may begin to potentially see a change with the impacts of COVID-19. Stores have an interest in taking certain tasks like cleaning and sanitizing under their own wing. And you've seen that with stores like Target, where many of the store associates that would be at the point of sale are now cleaning carts, for instance. So others like servicing broken shopping carts, I mentioned shopping carts, still make sense to outsource some of these tasks long term. You don't have a lot of store associates that would normally be stocking at night now fixing carts, so that will still go to a third-party company. However, you could make the argument that customers will feel slightly more comfortable when they walk into, say, a Safeway and see people in a Safeway uniform cleaning and sanitizing versus a third party who are often not wearing company colors or distinguishing uniforms, maybe just a dark blue shirt, for instance. And the argument could be made that stores might feel a lack of control by maybe farming out sanitation to a third party as well, making sure that when they have their store associates doing these certain tasks, that they're doing them in an appropriate fashion. The argument for outsourcing cleaning services is that it is often less expensive because you're paying these employees a little bit less. Since those services offer economies of scale too, you aren't really taking employees off the floor either, so to speak, so less coordination there. You can farm it out and then be done with it. But also, although this isn't something that customers would likely think about, it might be safer to outsource cleaning and sanitation. These firms literally do this all day, every day, any time of day, of course. And assigning certain existing store employees to do these tasks might be actually more dangerous despite any change in customer perception. So that's something to certainly think about. One interesting tidbit is that 12% of facilities maintenance professional staff were outsourced, which is a far drop from trades that are outsourced overall. Basically, this shows that most companies have staff who oversee facilities maintenance and the retention of outside services and would rather not outsource the professional positions. The industry snapshot did have a quick note about retail stores' lease agreements. Since facilities maintenance firms are usually keeping an eye towards these, especially for triple net leases where the retailer is responsible for the vast majority of repair and maintenance concerns regarding the immediate facilities. The average number of months in retail lease agreements is 97, as the survey period says. This is up only slightly from the earlier retail snapshots from Connex, and we would wager that this would hold steady or fall as fewer locations with 25 plus year leases are being built, especially in pharmacy and in grocery. Indeed, most new stores in 2020 are coming by the way of the likes of Dollar General, who typically signs 10 to 15 year leases right out of the gate, which is, of course, much less than those 20 or 25 year leases that we used to see from other retailers.
Now, other findings in the report include the breakdown of budgets and spending for preventative and corrective maintenance in retail stores. Now, stores actually budgeted less on a percentage basis for preventative maintenance than they actually used. So 33% of their outlay went towards preventative maintenance versus 31% budgeted, and the rest of the budget or actual outlay went towards corrective maintenance, which is maintenance done after, you know, something goes wrong, of course. Now, you might look at this as an opportunity area for retailers. After all, the old saying is an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, but things work a bit differently here for many retailers. For example, spending on corrective maintenance will be higher in general just because of the sheer cost of repair of some systems. So, for example, you can spend all the money you want on maintenance on an HVAC system or a refrigeration system, but sometimes they just go out. That's the reality of the business. And those systems are very expensive to replace, much more expensive than they would be to maintain. Also, it makes sense for retailers to put off certain replacements, like say an HVAC replacement, if they're planning on potentially closing a store and moving or renovating stores. And we've seen a lot of renovations of late. So it makes sense that maybe those retailers are going to put off replacements and then get bitten because they didn't manage to replace something before it went out. Now, to that point, I want to break down the budgets a little bit because Connex also broke down the typical facilities maintenance budgets for retail outlets. Taken as a whole, budgets for facilities maintenance came out to about $7.76 per square foot for the latest year tracked, and that's for retailers. So you imagine a company, for example, like Walmart, who might have a 100,000 plus square foot building. You think $7.76 per square foot, that comes out to, you know, potentially around a million or more than a million per year. Now, of this, when you break it down further, $2.96 of this amount was set aside for that repair and maintenance that we talked about, whether that be preventative or corrective. $2.40 was basically CapEx for system upgrades or improvements like we talked about. And then $2.39 went towards reimaging or remodeling. So we're looking at this. We're not only talking about, oh, hey, if a system goes down, but facilities maintenance and facilities management also has to do with remodeling. And what this suggests is more strength in a lot of brick and mortar retail and more investment in brick and mortar retail than is typically being portrayed in the media. For example, if over 30%, as we see here, is going towards reimaging or remodeling, and another 30% is going towards CapEx, retailers have to like their odds over the next several years. And you can make the argument, well, that's erroneous to do so, or, well, they're upgrading certain facilities to include buy online, pick up in store, and retrofitting that. And we have seen remodeling be a major subject for a number of retailers prior to COVID-19. Not only, though, because of buy online and pick up in store, because quite a bit of it for stores like Dollar General, for example, is independent of any buy online, pick up in store optionality because those retailers don't have that. And it's to refresh the store. It's to Layton's point earlier in the podcast, to put in more frozen foods, let's say, or to put in more fresh foods if you're a Dollar General, to make for a more appealing product selection. And this has paid off in most circumstances. We look at the success for the next-gen Family Dollar stores, for example, in terms of sales and the dynamics of customers there. But in part because of COVID-19 impacts, I think when the next snapshot comes out, we would expect budget breakdowns to be a lot different. Retailers spending more maybe on in-house facilities maintenance, spending more on facilities maintenance in general, but spending less proportionately on the CapEx and remodels because a lot of those have either had to be put off because of the pandemic and because of governmental regulations, or they've been put off because of cash flow issues. So we like looking at the numbers because it's given us a bigger picture of what's going on. More retailers are renovating and reimaging than one would be potentially led to believe, but also, it's important to acknowledge that these numbers very likely to change for retailers going forward. Well, finally, we'll wrap up the news portion of the podcast with a massive surprise via Office Depot, who crushed analyst estimates in their first quarter earnings call. Now, I say crushing it is relative, since not much was expected from Office Depot in a quarter that especially caught the beginning of work from home and pandemic buying. Even still, sales declines for the company were not as large as expected, and they posted an earnings per share beat. They also adopted a poison pill provision, which we'll address shortly towards the end of the story, but we're not going to be discussing that as much as their sales and sales trends. Now, as we look at the numbers, we begin with that adjusted earnings per share beat. So they saw adjusted earnings per share come in at 12 cents for their fiscal first quarter versus analyst estimates of 8 cents. Now, this came as a result of operating income of $108 million and net income of $45 million. Both were massively up from last year. Operating income to that point up 233%. Net income was up 463%. So far more profitable on the revenue they did bring in than they were last year. And operating income margin was up as well, which makes sense. If you look at it, sales were down, profit was up. So operating income went from 0.9% of overall revenue last year to 2.9% this year. Now, sales did fall, as we mentioned briefly earlier, by 2% year over year. Overall reported sales for the company came in at $2.7 billion. It's important to note at this point, not all of their revenue comes through brick and mortar, but the number that caught us most by surprise was a 2% increase in same-store sales over last year. They noted that e-commerce sales, of course, were up significantly as well. There were two main reasons for their overall revenue and sales being down from last year, because if you're looking, same-store sales, a 2% increase for Office Depot is great. Honestly, that's a positive number for them, regardless of what inflation is in the sector, because they've been struggling to put up those positive numbers of late. So the reason their sales were down from last year, store closures, 64 of them to be precise, and also a 5% drop in revenues from their service division. The service division was impacted specifically and significantly by COVID-19, and this includes both the retail service division and CompuCom, a company that they acquired a few years back. Now, it's interesting. We said during the last time we talked about Office Depot that they were seeking to become maybe more of a service-oriented company, a contracts-oriented company. Kind of wondered aloud how long they would continue to have that retail identity. Well, the pandemic appears to have reinvigorated management's feelings regarding their retail division, and they were bullish on several categories in this call.
And we'll get into those categories in just a second. But, you know, one of the things that we noticed, Trent, is what is going to happen to a number of retailers who had the ability to remain open, like Office Depot. So we were really curious in this particular instance, how are Office Depot or Staples, for that matter, going to be during the pandemic, and how would they come in post-pandemic as well? The stores that we've seen had almost completely empty parking lots, and with most people working from home that work in maybe a white-collar atmosphere, it remained to be seen exactly how they would be servicing their traditional customers. However, they did see an increase in demand overall as a result of COVID-19. As it relates to this report, the demand was, like we Trent had alluded to, category specific, as could be guessed. So let's look at those categories. What they call their adjacency categories, such as cleaning and break room supplies, saw a 25% sales increase in their business solutions division. Technology sales were also up in this division as well by around 10%. Office Depot has been bullish on adjacency categories in the last 2 years, mentioning them repeatedly during corporate presentations. And although this probably wasn't the situation they envisioned when they said they had high marks to be achieved over the next couple of years, they now stand to significantly benefit from their build out. And really, it's been an amazing build out over the past couple of years, and now they're seeing the sales come in during this time. Meanwhile, they saw a decrease in sales from their contract channels, basically companies that they have contracts with. It makes sense that things like paper and in-office computing solutions would not exactly be flying off the shelves right now. Again, a lot of people are working from home. They don't need a lot of printer paper for their own office doings. But one other thing they mentioned that caught us completely off guard, they saw an increase in sales of managed copy and print services. And overall, this was a 14% revenue increase. If you squint, this makes slight sense as employees aren't able to use in-office print or ship stations. However, while shipping volume may not have drastically changed, you wonder what is driving the printing traffic, especially now with so many documents being digital or digitally shared and the overall number of business-to-business presentations being curtailed right now. We should note that these services saw a benefit basically through e-commerce. In-store copy and print services were down around 11%. They noted that a substantial majority, and I quote that, of their stores were allowed to stay open given their position selling work from home items and educational facilitation materials. And if you look, furniture was a category that was up, likely as a result of people building their home offices. And Trent, I spoke to an IT professional, an IT manager, who actually said that their staff, regardless of this pandemic, they are looking now in the future to having work from home availability for most of their associates. So they're helping out in terms of financing office furniture and setting up VPNs and the whole IT side of things as well. But they have to go through somewhere for this kind of thing. And I think Staples and Office Depot are going to be the two big companies selling these kinds of products. But learn from home products as well. Learn from home enabling products were hot sellers in this most recent period. Their retail division saw a 26% increase in buy online, pick up in store year over year, which is ultimately good for the company, provided they make a positive impression while having this service provided. One interesting thing is that they did mention while office supply shortages did not hamper them in Q1, they feel as though supply chain constraints for cleaning and break room supplies will likely hamper sales in the second quarter. This, along with trimmed store hours for most of April, as they have been closing stores around 2 hours earlier. So the positive here, on one hand, you have stores that have been able to remain open because governments deem them as essential when they supply supplies for work from home individuals. The downside is they close 2 to 3 hours earlier. And so regardless of how you look at that, you're thinking that the sales window has shrunk. That's going to ultimately affect their top line sales. In any case, the company was brash in their earnings release with a sub headline reading highest net cash position in 2 years. This is ultimately a short term positive, but they may well need this cash position if work from home trends continue. They have around $1.7 billion in available liquidity, but we're still hesitant to call this a turning point from the company until we know exactly what the long-term impacts from COVID-19 might be. They still do have, by the way, 1,295 stores in their retail division. It certainly seems like they have less with the store closures recently, but their brick-and-mortar footprint is still pretty significant. Due in part to their strong financial position, they adopted the poison pill with an eye towards staving off potential takeovers designed to take advantage of a smaller than usual market cap as a result of the market downturn. They were careful to note that it was not in response to a specific takeover bid, but rather in anticipation of something going down in the future.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, where we each take a look at a story we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year. And Layton's got a story that kind of dovetails with today's interview as far as rents coming in from retailers, particularly those that were forced to close due to the pandemic.
Yeah, this was one of the stories that you had found, Trent, and we both found it very interesting because oftentimes in media, negative leads. And so you tend to think that a lot of REITs out there are facing really hard times, and they are. There are a lot of landlords who are suffering from non-payment activity. However, there are some bright spots out there, and this was an article that was written very recently that said, really noted a lot of positives in Kimco's business, a huge REIT with over 400 grocery anchored centers in the United States. So they've invested, they've really doubled down on grocery anchored shopping centers, those outdoor shopping centers, not necessarily smaller regional centers, but larger centers with maybe a PetSmart or a main grocery store there to anchor a larger store base. But operating 400 grocery anchored centers, you're looking at a company that has faced a lot of vulnerability over the past couple of months with a lot of stores, nail salons, all of the adjacent retailers that would be at a shopping center like the ones they own, shutting down completely. But a lot of good news. Again, they noted that 78% of rents came in from their top 50 tenants, which is a really good thing. Most likely to be expected because of a lot of those retailers being national credit retailers that have a lot of strong balance sheet proposition. However, the really good positive for them is 40% of rents came in from tenants that had to close during the COVID-19 shutdown. So we're thinking here of restaurants, a lot of restaurants that had to shut down. Again, other areas in retail such as those servicing customers more on the service side, so nail salons, barbershops, that sort of thing, 40% of those retailers ended up paying rent to those Kimco properties. It's very interesting here because if you see remarks from their CEO, Connor Flynn, he said he was very humbled by their associates' focus on both tenant and community support during this time. And adjacent to that, Trent, one of the things they have been doing, they rolled out a Kimco curbside pickup program, which basically enables them to build out some facilities in the parking lot, mostly just drive up or curbside pickup infrastructure there with good signage, paint on the sidewalks, paint on the parking lots themselves to denote a curbside pickup area for the retailers to help those retailers. This is something that the retailers are not paying for. So we talk about tenant assistance here from the landlord perspective. They truly are trying to help those tenants that are able to stay in business and to help keep their associates safe by not having to go up to the actual store to pick up items that they had purchased online. So I think that's a very, very interesting tactic from Kimco. They do ultimately want their retailers, their tenants, to succeed. And I think that's a very interesting proposition. They see that right now it's a struggle for most retailers. Even if you are a national credit retailer, and anything that they can do to help, they will. And in fact, they actually secured a $590 million unsecured loan during this COVID-19 crisis. And they also have a tenant assistance program that actually engages law firms nationwide to help all of their tenants really look to secure some of those government subsidized loans that everybody has been talking about. We're talking about the SBA PPP loans, wherein if you have utilities, a rent or mortgage payment, and are paying employees during this particular time during COVID-19, you will receive some funds, some of which you don't have to pay back. So I think this is a very good position that Flynn, again, the CEO, is taking here. And you're seeing that he has a lot of positive remarks regarding the future of his company and the retailers that are supplying him with those monthly rent payments.
Well, my looking ahead story isn't so much business specific as it was for Leighton, but mine is more industry specific. We've talked so much over the last 5 years about grocery stores adding restaurants in store and that type of thing. But recently, we've seen a trend throughout the restaurant industry to add grocery staples to restaurants. And the reason I bring this up, Panera, of course, launched their Panera Grocery about a month ago now as sales begin to ramp up for them. Their Panera Grocery is essentially only through pickup or delivery. You can buy bread, you can buy milk or dairy, you can buy fresh produce. The selections are fairly limited, though, for Panera. But the reason I'm looking ahead at this story is I want to look back to the past, because there's a restaurant, or really a QSR, if you will, called Brahms. And most of our listeners probably aren't familiar with Brahms. They typically have locations in Kansas and Oklahoma and Texas, especially in Texas. There's a lot around there and the surrounding states. And they started basically as a dairy outlet. They were branded as ice cream and dairy stores, so to speak, but began to fold in some QSR aspects to them. In the early 90s, they became more of a restaurant than anything. And now in the 2000s, over the last 10 to 12 years, they've started to renovate their stores to build out what they call the fresh market portion. So you walk into a Brahms and it's about 50-50 between the restaurant and the grocery store portion. Now, Brahms stores have been in a unique position during these shutdowns because they've been able to make sure people have interior access to the stores, which in theory could also increase the number of takeout orders. So we've seen other restaurants, Panera among them, but also a number of local restaurants adopt the same thing. Another restaurant doing so is Rib Crib. They were selling bath tissue along with their barbecue. And actually, several customers were complaining because the bath tissue they felt like was overpriced. You're looking at prices of $2 to $3 per roll in some markets. So people felt like there was price gouging. But the reason I'm looking ahead is, are restaurants going to adopt grocery mechanisms as they work out of the pandemic? Is this something that they are going to put in their facilities, in their locations, to attempt to not only maybe make a little bit of money on the side because they've got those connections, obviously, with food service providers, but also if, and this is something that people are talking about, this is kind of speculative, but if there is a second wave of this pandemic or if there is a future pandemic, that might allow them to maybe stay open. And if you can stay open, you can serve ready-to-eat meals, you can serve other things that just using, say, Grubhub or something along those lines with those exorbitant fees, you could do there. So it gives you more of an option as a restaurant. So is this something that people are going to adopt more permanently? If so, how will that affect aspect of retail we haven't talked about in a few weeks in convenience stores? Because convenience stores to this point have kind of existed in that same area where the Brahms stores do, the Fresh Market stores do. Convenience stores are continuing to pick up on fresh produce and other ready-to-eat items as well as restaurants in those convenience stores. So I think all of that brings about kind of an interesting dynamic. Is this something that Panera and other restaurants are going to keep? How will that affect the sale of convenience stores? And to an extent, how will it affect the sale of grocery stores? So it really kind of cuts two ways here as businesses begin to kind of meld together and you see restaurants entering in grocery where grocery was entering the restaurant business just a few years ago. So really interested to see how that plays out over the next 6 months or so. Well, that'll do it for us on the Retail Focus podcast. A big thanks once again to Megan Martindale, again of CBRE, for joining us on today's show. We'll have a couple of interviews coming up next week we're very excited about. We've got Derek O'Carroll, who is the CEO of Bright Pearl, as well as Carl Haller from IBM. Super excited for next week's episode. We'll see you about 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.